We don't have a quorum, but we're going to continue a presentation from Human Services, and they should be coming down pretty soon. This committee gets along very well together, but we also act like the Senate.
Okay, thank you.
Bye. Welcome to our committee. Since we aren't going to pass your bill anyway, we appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chuck Johnson, Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services with the Department of Human Services. Mr. Chair, we have four additional budget pages that I wanted to get through. The first one is on page 52. It's entitled TANF-related expenditures designated as maintenance of effort. This page deals with the two-parent families in the Minnesota Family Investment Program. Currently, the two-parent families in MFIP are paid for with general funds, and those general funds are counted as part of our maintenance of effort under the TANF program. This was done in, I believe, 2001, the shift in funding, as a way to help us mitigate the risk of being penalized for not meeting the two-parent work participation rate in TANF. By moving these families into a general fund program, what was at that time called a separate state program. The new federal law, the Deficit Reduction Act, that was signed by the President in February, no longer allows states to have separate state programs that are outside of the TANF work participation rates. So with those federal changes, we're proposing to continue to fund the two-parent families with general fund dollars, but to not count those dollars as maintenance of effort. The effect of that is that we need to find additional maintenance effort within existing state appropriations, $14.5 million in 2007 and $19.4 million per year thereafter. The governor proposes to find additional MOE within the working family credit using a portion of state spending within the Minnesota Department of Education budget, and in 2007 also looking to a portion of the MFIP cash and DWP cash assistance. For 2008 and 2009, the additional MOE would come from the working family credit and from the state spending within MDE. This page doesn't change our policy toward two-parent families and MFIP. Those families are still subject to the work requirements, the sanctions, the time limits, just as they are under the current state law. This is simply a funding shift to accommodate the change in the federal law.
Mr. Johnson, in the Deficit Reduction Act that was just signed, as you said, by the President, there seems to be some cuts in family collaboratives within County Human Services, and it's collaborating many other places, and this is a huge concern to the people of my district, and I'm hearing from other people's districts. Is there any money presently in any of the governor's plans? I hear there's some money for mental health and stuff like that. Could that be focused in that direction at all?
Mr. Chair, there is some money in the governor's mental health proposal that addresses some of the reductions that were made to the collaborative funding in the Deficit Reduction Act. It addresses some of the reductions in funding that affected the children's mental health collaboratives and replaces some of that funding, I believe, with grants that would go to support some of the school-based services that would otherwise have lost funding under the Deficit Reduction Act changes. So that's within the governor's mental health proposal.
Okay, go. Thank you. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been getting phone calls from a few people about 4D and how they collect, how they get caught up in the child support collection system, even when there's no evidence that they've missed payments. Does that happen?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, a person can be in the 4D system by the judge's order to have their wages garnished to pay the child support, regardless of whether there's any history of not paying. That's something that I believe judges do under the law. And families can pull themselves out of that if it's agreed by both the non-custodial and the custodial parent that they don't want to have that happen. But otherwise, that's my understanding, is the default is the judges will order that the payments be processed through the central payment center.
Let me get this. I'm kind of confused here. If someone has no history of missing a payment, has never made a payment, the judge can just say, I want you to go into a collection service?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I don't know about a collection service per se, but into the system that is operated by the state, which would garnish the wages and have those payments sent through the payment center and then sent to the custodial parent. That's the default mechanism for paying child support when there's a child support order made in Minnesota.
That's the default? Mr. Chair, that's the default position, so it becomes automatic?
Mr. Sheriff Mahoney, that's my understanding, yes, of how the state law governs child support payments.
And is there a fee charged for that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, there is a fee charge, 1% of the payment to non-public assistance cases. If both parties, the non-custodial parent and the custodial parent, agree that they want to operate outside of that system, they can ask to be outside of the system and then not have to pay the fee, and then the payments would be made on a voluntary basis between the parties.
So I'm trying to understand this. So if there's never been a history of a mispayment or anything, and a judge just arbitrarily decides that he or she wants to put the non-custodial parent into this, have their wages garnished. Well, let's say it's $1,000 a month child support payment. The kid's going to be missing $10, or are they going to take the $10 off of that $1,000, or are they just going to add the $10 to that $1,000? Do you know?
Mr. Chair, from Mahoney, it comes out of the payment.
Interesting. That is interesting. I guess I will have to. That person doesn't live in my district, so maybe I'll have to call them back. That's right area for an amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. You can continue.
Mr. Chair, the next budget page is on page 54. It's entitled County Flexibility to Address One-Time Acceleration of Timing of Child Care Payments. Mr. Chair, this page relates to the implementation of a statewide computer system to support the Child Care Assistance Program. The system is called MEC Squared. Currently, some counties are on a current version of MEC Squared, which will be updated, and a number of counties are not on that system. For many of the counties that are not on that system, the payments that they make to providers under the Child Care Assistance Program are sometimes lagged by a month or even 2 months, depending on what kind of a system or what kind of manual system they're using. When the MEC Squared system is put into place, those payments will start to happen on more of a real-time basis. The provider submits a bill, and the payment goes out within a few days. What that means is that in the year when counties implement the MEC Squared system, they'll have, in a sense, 13 months of payment within a 12-month period. That cost is built into the forecast for the MFIP and transition year parts of the Child Care Assistance Program. However, for the basic sliding fee program, this program is funded by allocations to counties, and counties have some challenges in managing those allocations within the calendar year that they're made. This rider that this budget page supports essentially just gives the county some flexibility to manage their appropriations across the two allocation years from calendar year 07 to calendar year 08 or even to calendar year 09, depending on when MEC Squared is implemented in that county. There's no net cost to this. It simply allows the counties to manage the dollars by putting some from the next year's allocation if they need to in order to manage within their allocations across the 2 years when MEC Squared is implemented.
If the county would have money left over from 1 year, can they carry it into the next year?
Mr. Chair, the rules on that are that they are allowed to carry the dollars into the next year if they've spent at least 90% of their allocation. So there's some ability for them to manage those dollars into the next year, but only if they're making an effort to fully expend up to that 90% level, the allocation that they have.
Okay, sure. Representative Slowick.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson, are the counties so bought into this, and have they approved this? Have they been part of the process?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the counties have been very involved in the development of the MEC Squared system, are supportive of having this flexibility to manage their basic sliding fee allocations.
We have a quorum here now, so we'll officially start the meeting. So you started talking, everybody came in, what's that?
So do I need to hit the gavel to officially start it, or? Proceed, thanks.
Mr. Chair, the next page is page 56, Federal Hurricane Relief Funds County Allocation. Mr. Chair, this page supports a rider. In response to the Katrina disaster, some hurricane evacuees did come to Minnesota, and we did provide services to those hurricane evacuees. Federal government has put in place various ways of reimbursing states for the costs of that. In particular, on this page, the federal government has allocated us $154,000 for costs spent under Social Services Block Grant for hurricane evacuees in Minnesota. This page supports a rider which would allocate that $154,000 to the counties that actually provided the relief in proportion to the expenditures they made in actual payments to hurricane evacuees.
Any questions for the testifier on that?
Mr. Chair, the final budget page, page 57, is called TANF CCDF Refinancing. Mr. Chair, this is a page that supports the funding for the Governor's Early Childhood Initiatives. This page refinances TANF through the Child Care Development Fund, about $10 million, a little over $10 million a year for each of the fiscal years 07, 08, and 09. What this essentially does is takes TANF, expends those TANF dollars which are currently on the bottom line, about $10 million a year, into the CCDF, or into the Child Care Assistance Program, the MFIP Transition Your Child Care Assistance Program, takes out a like amount of general fund dollars and uses those general fund dollars to support the Governor's Early Childhood Initiative. This does not change or affect the benefits or services provided to any of the families under the CCAP program. It's simply a funding mechanism change.
Representative Spawley.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Johnson, you know, this is always really hard for us to understand. When we're doing these TANF shifts, I know we've done them, I don't know how many years now, but we've done them for several years. If this money wasn't changed like this, what would the money be spent for? How would that work?
Mr. Chair, Representative Slough, if the TANF money were not spent like this, it would be available for other expenditures as the governor might propose or the legislature might consider. And that would include any TANF-eligible expenditures, which is a fairly broad net, or transfers to Child Care Development Fund or transfers to the Social Services Block Grant, which are also allowable under TANF. So there's a broad range of things that the dollars could be used for. This proposal is to refinance it to free up general fund dollars to support the Governor's Early Childhood Initiative.
Representative Slowick.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson, I just want to ask a question. If the legislature didn't spend all of the $10 million on child care, or what happens to the rest of it? Just does it revert to the general fund, or is it spent somewhere else, or what happens to that?
And Mr. Chair, Slowick, if the legislature doesn't use, there's about $30 million, a little over $30 million that are in the TANF account right now. There's a positive balance of about $30 million. If the legislature didn't spend all that and ended the session, whatever was left over would remain in the TANF account, would potentially be available again next year, but it would depend on what happened in the November forecast. This is sort of the tricky part. In the November forecast, if the MFIP caseload were to go up or the child care caseload were to change in some way, those dollars couldn't end up being absorbed into the forecast, and you come back next year with no TANF balance. So it sort of depends on what happens in the November forecast. But if you don't spend all the dollars this year, they stay in the TANF reserve account and then are available for TANF use next year if they aren't absorbed by the forecast.
I'm just thought.
Mr. Johnson, so that's interesting. I mean, so do we actually have $30 million we could potentially spend out of TANF reserve for this year?
Mr. Chair and Representative Slough, the way that we manage the TANF account is we look at the balance that's available at the end of the budget period, which in this case is fiscal year 09. We're at about a three-year horizon right now because we're in the second year of the biennium. That balance is a little over $30 million. And the way we approach the expenditures is that those dollars could be expended any time or in any way over that three-year period, and we'd remain in balance. This proposes to spend it evenly in $10 million each year.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Mahoney.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, we do these TANF shifts on a regular basis. And there's generally a reason for it that I generally don't that I don't agree with. You know, the governor, you indicated two or three times that this is because the governor's governor's initiative, and it's all in child care. Is the governor's initiative, how do I want to say this? Because I'm trying to figure out if the governor's trying, who he's trying to help with his initiative. Because if he's trying to help low-income families, he could just use TANF for that initiative. It looks like we're moving TANF to cover general fund. So does the governor's initiative address, could his initiative use TANF funds?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, it's likely that a portion of what the governor's early childhood initiative is spending on could be, we could use direct TANF to do, but probably not all of it, or we know not all of it.
Could you give us a ratio?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I don't have a ratio. We could look at it more closely and try to determine that. My understanding is that there are a couple of issues. There are some of the expenditures within the Governor's Early Childhood Initiative that are not, just as a type of expenditure, that are not eligible to use TANF for. And then there's also a portion of the money that goes to supporting, for instance, grants to child care providers to upgrade the quality of their care in order to meet a certain kind of level of designation for school readiness. And that a portion of those dollars would be supporting programs that provide care to low-income families, but not all of them. And that would be the other issue, is how much of that those dollars might be going to support programs for families that are not within the low income. So there's sort of those two pieces that would have to be sorted out. We refinance TANF sometimes to pay for other things that we might be able to use TANF for, just because it's easier to use general fund for it. It's easier to administer and not have to do the tracking and so forth that's associated with TANF. So to some extent, what's being done here isn't simply because we can't use TANF for it. It's because by using general fund, it's just going to be easy to administer the dollars and to not have as much tracking going on between us and MDE as to how the money is being used.
My thinking is, I mean, we know the governor's proposal didn't move forward in the House, okay? So there's $10 million out there. You know, there could be an amendment on the floor. There could be, I mean, we don't know exactly what's going to happen with that. What happens if that money just doesn't move forward? Is it just because it's used for general fund money, is it then just put somewhere else?
Mr. Chair and Representative Slawick, if the House doesn't adopt this page and doesn't adopt the governor's early childhood proposal, or doesn't use TANF to do it, these dollars would stay in the TANF account. Now, what may happen is there may be another proposal to do something else with the TANF dollars that is not what the governor is proposing in this refinancing or in the expenditure on early childhood. And that would be obviously up to the appropriations committees in the House to make those decisions.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Slaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like the members to know, of course, I would like it to be used on early childhood. I mean, that's what I hope we do with it. And even though the governor's proposal didn't move forward at this exact point, it may move forward in some point that could be helpful to young children, but it's not clear at this point. So I think it's there's trade-offs.
Where are we at? Is this yours or mine?
And potentially, I mean, hopefully it's going to help early childhood programs and little kids.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you. Could you give me that ratio that we spoke of earlier? I mean, how much of what the governor is doing is TANF and how much isn't, and just so that I have a sense of it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, yes, we can take that back and try to make that determination.
Thank you.
Continue, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, that is the end of the Department of Human Services budget pages.
Okay, members, any more questions? We can always, Mr. Johnson's always available for questions, by the way. He's very good that way.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Abler. Okay.
Everything's already done?
No, I just told him where I was. Representative Abler, you changed a little bit.
Just a little bit.
Since he's not here, I'm sure you got better looking. Well, we're waiting. Representative Slawik, did you thoroughly read the minutes of April 4th?
Absolutely.
Will you approve those, please?
Yes.
All those. Representative Slawik approves the minutes of April 4th. All in favor of those approving those minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Pass. Thank you. Representative Westerberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I have the privilege here of bringing forward a bill that I'm a co-author on, House File 3964, and I'd like to move that before the committee.
Very well.
And members, House File 3964 is a bill that appropriates money from the general fund to the Commissioner of Human Services for Community Action Programs. These programs are designed to assist participants to achieve self-sufficiency. And members, I just want to call your attention to the fact that this community action program served over 200,000 people here in the state of Minnesota, and I think it's really important for us to make sure that we're doing everything we can here to adequately help this program. If you look at the bill, you'll see that it talks about an appropriation of $6.5 million in 2006 and $5.5 million in 2007. But keep in mind that those are over the base. The base is $4 million. So what we're asking for is actually $2.5 million the first year and $1.5 million in the second year. And with that, members, I'll yield to our testifiers.
Very well.
All right.
Would you please give your name for the record?
I will do that. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike Thorstenson, and I'm chair of the Minnesota Community Action Association this year and executive director of Three Rivers Community Action, which is in Goodhue, Rice, and Wabasha County area. With me this morning is Pat McFarland from Anoka County Community Action, Mary Sullivan, who now took the back seat. She loves that role. With the director of Scott Carver Dakota Community Action Program, Gene Eliason, who's with the Scott Carver Community Action Program. They will all make a few comments about programs and impacts. Representative Abler's bill, 3964, restores part of the $4.25 million cut the community action programs were impacted with statewide in 2003. There are 28 community action agencies across the state of Minnesota which serve all 87 counties and provide services to over 200,000 people around the state, and 60% of those families and people who receive services are working families. A number are disabled and seniors and so forth. Cuts impacted youth programs, housing programs, crisis program, working families, and so forth. I wanted to focus quickly on two things. Three Rivers Community Action gets $82,615 per year from the Minnesota Community Action Grant Program. With that, I'm going to focus on two programs that are impacted by those dollars. One is the Home Delivered Meals Program. We have over 1,389 volunteers throughout the three-county area, and they provide services, volunteer services. If you value those, the time that they put in at minimum wage, they would put in about $210,000 a year of volunteer time. Of those volunteers, every day there's at least 35 volunteers delivering home-delivered meals to homebound seniors within our three-county area. One of the fastest growing demographics of the population is the over 80 senior population. And what this helps to do is to keep these seniors in their homes so that they don't end up on another part of the human services budget in nursing homes and so forth. So and it also provides a lot of contact, and in most cases, that may be the only daily human contact at the door that these seniors have. So that does a very important thing around volunteers. And statewide, there are literally thousands and thousands of volunteers involved with everything from transportation to home-delivered meals, to many other kinds of programs, as well as volunteers in some of the self-help housing programs. The second thing I want to focus on is that at Three Rivers, we do a lot of housing development, a lot of workforce housing development. In the past 6 years, we've done over 300 units of housing, and of that, over $30 million in housing expenditures, $26 million of those dollars are private dollars. And all of our housing programs through our program are done with private contractors. So these are bid out, and this helps create jobs in the area as well. So part of what community action grants do around the state is create investment and also help create job opportunities. So from an investment standpoint, I believe, and others do, that it's one of the best investments you can make of your dollars. So with that, we also add, with each year that we do housing, we add anywhere from $80,000 to $100,000 on the local property tax base. So from an investment standpoint, that alone would be a dollar-for-dollar return. So we're kind of proud of that. And we wanted to share a little bit of that with you this morning because no doubt you just want to jump forward and restore the funding cuts to the program from there. Next, I will turn it over to Mary Sullivan with Scott Carver Dakota.
You know, that would be a good idea to do that, but I'd have to learn how to spin gold on a straw.
Do what?
Spin gold on a straw? I would have to learn how to do that, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
My name is Mary Sullivan, and I'm the director for the Community Action Program in Scott Carver and Dakota Counties. And I have with me this morning, and I'm proud to introduce Gene, who has been involved with the CAP agency for a year now. And she's here to tell you her story on how the CAP agency has been of help to her, and the reason we have we're helping her is with the funds that we use from the CAP grant.
Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record, please.
My name is Jenny Lyason. I'm a recipient. I don't know how to do this formally. I'm supposed to address you, Mr. Chair and members. But anyway.
Just talking like you talk to your neighbor.
Okay, thank you. I've been a recipient of and received benefits from CAP agency on behalf of myself and I have custody of four of my grandchildren.
Wow.
I'm on Social Security. I've had illness I'm affected with lupus. And so it's been, just a wonderful benefit having the support and the help from the CAP agency. My grandchildren have been enrolled in, Head Start program through CAP agency. They were floundering when I became custodial grandmother, and they range in ages from 17, which is not CAP agency ages, but 5, 4, and a year old. These children have been in my total care and in sole support on Social Security for them, which is not able to support them, you know. So CAP agency has helped me immensely. I come up slack every month on rent and that type of thing. And so I have received total clothing from CAP agency through almost a year and a half now for the children. And the benefits of all of this has worked us into a position now where we're becoming stabilized as a family, which is the children would have ended up in foster care had I not taken the custodial role for them, and it would have been separated in their from their siblings. So. But they've all stabilized into becoming just healthy young children, happy, and so with the benefit of having early Head Start for Tyler, they have home visits where the teachers come out to the house, and I give you all these wonderful informational sheets each week as far as how to deal with children. And at my age, I've kind of forgotten. I raised five children, but I still have forgotten how to, you know, take care of a toddler and raise them. But these kids have just blossomed and excelled. And it, I have to honestly tell you that...
Yep. If I wouldn't have had this help, you know, through this wonderful agency, I would not, we wouldn't have survived. And we would have ended up in a shelter, you know, that, something like that, if the benefits of, that they afford you or give to you wouldn't have been there. These people have been supportive, and teachers have been wonderful. So I just have been very aware that a lot of these, I've just recently been more informed about policies of CAP agency and what the programs that they're working on toward the education of these small children, and they're the future of our country. You know, these kids would slide back into nothing, you know, if they didn't have people like this out there that are working to help them survive and stabilize. And the basic thing is stabilizing and having normal homes instead of these young mothers and myself, an old grandma. But with us kind of, you know, what are we going to do? How are we going to do this? And the children being so scattered, you know, because of our unstableness. So this has afforded me the stableness. I guess that's about all I've got to say.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome to our committee.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Patrick McFarland with Anoka County Community Action Program in Blaine, Minnesota. I want to thank the committee for the support that you've given us over the years, Mr. Chairman and members. I think it's been very much appreciated by the agencies, and we know we're in very difficult budget times. But I want to say that the legislature did not appropriate this fund. This was unallotted by the governor. And it was only when the community with children, family, and learning, now we're in the Department of Human Services, but so it was a governor unallotment that got us in the base. I had a handout that was passed out just a minute ago just to kind of show you some of the effects that happened at Anoka County Community Action Program. We received in 2002 $236,000 in this program. In 2004, we received $123,000. You can see the effects of where we had to cut the budget. Unfortunately, we have a lot of mandated services, so we didn't have a lot of flexibility. So we had a car loan, car repair program that we worked with our partners up in the Blaine Human Service Center. It was free to be and SEEP, Community Emergency Assistance Program. We had to discontinue our support for those programs. Energy assistance, we had cuts in that program. Homeownership programs, our homeownership counseling programs, we had some cuts in that program. And housing was the biggest cut that we took. That was our housing, affordable rental housing development program. And we had been developing somewhere between 10 to 12 units in Anoka County, affordable rental housing, per year. And we haven't done anything since in development in that area since the cuts. I want to close, Mr. Chairman, by saying Minnesota has the second lowest poverty rate in the nation behind New Hampshire. We have a much more heterogeneous population than New Hampshire does. I think the reason that that is because of the work of this committee, the work that you folks do in workforce centers, community action, early childhood education, all those programs. We certainly can do more, but I think we should be proud of what we have done in the past. Thank you very much.
Good way to look at it. We have anybody else testifying? Questions from the committee? Representative Smollett.
Mr. Chair and to the testifiers, Representative Westberg, it's really an editorial comment about the, was it spinning straw in the gold? Hay in the gold. That's from one of those fairy tales.
One of those fairy tales or something. I think it was...
Rapunzel? No, that was one where...
What was it?
Trump was supposed to... Now we've cleared that up.
You should be out of that. We'll have a lot of money spent.
I just wanted to say that this has been is such an interesting committee because we debate everything from biotech to people's lives. And biotech actually affects people's lives, but I really look at the work that the Community Action programs do as being so important in your testimony and about government supporting our basic services is part of our job. And I hope we can look at the trade-offs between what we fund in this committee and that we're creating, you know, the people that sort of on low income and the high income and the people sort of in there, especially towards the lower level, they're losing. And it's very serious, and I want to say I appreciate the bill, and I hope we'll be able to restore some of this funding.
Very good comments. Mr. Thorstenson, in Three Rivers, you came up with a lot of housing. Was that using the Challenge Grant and getting those partners?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, we use the Challenge Grant, and we try to leverage every private and public dollar. That's Greater Minnesota Housing Fund, First Home Rochester.
You have a wonderful story to tell there. I appreciate what you've done. Tell your friend from Anoka County how to do it. I think that was a...
We learned from them, actually.
Did you really? Yeah, one of these figures is pretty good. I appreciate the fact that we have had some cuts, and I know that discretionary money and MOEG grants and stuff like that has been eroded, although relative to other states we're really, really high, but we've been used to a higher standard than many other states have been, and Representative Clark and Slawick remind me of that quite often. But I think I appreciated the testimony very much, and it was a good presentation. Anybody else have anything to say? Representative Clark.
I just have a question. I apologize. I had some other stuff that I couldn't be in here earlier. But I was just noticing two programs that I know I've been involved with in the past, and that's the youth build that was cut. And I don't know if you talked about housing that was lost from that. I know the impact on kids, of course, is pretty severe. But could you mention the loss of housing at all with that? And if you didn't, could you? Because we know they build housing.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we have not participated in youth build in the last few years, but we have used youth build in the past and have done a wide variety of projects. I should say, Mr. Chairman, we own and operate 400 units of housing in Anoka County through a variety of resources, including things like old convents and the whole nine yards. So we are very active in the housing area. My point was that we're losing our development side of things at this point because of the cuts to MEOG. So we operate a lot of housing, but we're just not developing more housing, and that's our biggest single need that we've determined from the CAP agency in Anoka County is affordable housing.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Clark.
Just the other program I noticed, the FAME program was eliminated, and I don't know if everybody here is familiar with that, but that Governor Plenty and I both worked on that together, and so I don't know, maybe we need to appeal to him directly, because I had the bill, and then Republicans took the legislature, and I gave it to him, and he carried it through, and it's really all about helping poor people use their assets and become homeowners and go to school, and that's totally eliminated from you folks now, is that right? Is that what I'm reading here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, the FAME program has not been eliminated, but there have been cutbacks in terms of some of the matching support for the FAME program. So to the best of my knowledge, that's still functioning, although at a little bit of a reduced capacity because there are not the kind of cap grant dollars to do some of the match.
The state funding is what's eliminated. Maybe that's what that means here. There's no state funding. Okay. That's too bad, because it's really all about helping people pull themselves up with support from the private and public sector.
Any other questions? Seeing none. Representative Westerberg renews his motion to have House File 3964 laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Representative Cornish.
Mr.
Can we put that in? Representative Cornish, is it your will to have this bill rolled over for possible inclusion or to go to the floor?
Mr. Chair, be my desire to have it rolled over for possible inclusion in the bill.
I will move House File 3947 for possible inclusion on an omnibus bill.
Mr. Chair and members, House File 3947 is a very short bill. What it does is it would direct the Center for Rural Policy Development to make a report to the legislature on the status of rural Minnesota by March 1st of each odd-numbered year. And Mr. Chair, maybe sometime between now and your finished product, we can talk about who that report would go to. So a lot of times these things are, we'll say they'll be studied or furnished to the chair of such and such committee, but maybe I can work on it with you to direct that. Members, I belong to the Center for Rural Policy Development, and it didn't take long after being on this board that I found out that rural Minnesota needs lots of attention. Also belong to the I-90 corridor group with Representative Gunther and others, and at times we are definitely in need of information and facts on rural Minnesota. As you know, rural Minnesota suffered a lot in the 1900. It was just there was like two-thirds of the population was on the farms in the rural area. Now like 3% is made up by farm population. The education, we've got the schools that have, a lot of them have consolidated. The businesses have closed. The demographics and the business scene has changed drastically. And to affect any positive change, like the I-90 corridor and the Center for Rural Policy Development, and other rural groups need pertinent information. And so just what this bill is about, it would have a study come forth by the Center for Rural Policy Development. And I've got Dr. Jack Geller here with me from the center and would explain to you what this study might entail and how it would help us with the information that we've received.
Welcome to our committee. Give you a name for the record.
For the record, good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jack Geller. I'm the president of the Center for Rural Policy and Development. I've had the pleasure of talking to this committee over the years many times. As you know, the Center for Rural Policy and Development is Minnesota's only rural policy research center. Over the past 8 years, we've conducted dozens of studies on a variety of issues that are important to rural Minnesotans and the communities they reside in, from the adoption and diffusion of high-speed telecommunications throughout rural Minnesota to multiple reports and updates on how the administration's Job Z program is going. We strive to keep our research nonpartisan, contemporary, accurate, and, as I often say, politically unspun. We don't lobby. We try to give policymakers like yourself, as well as county commissioners, municipal officers, officials, good, accurate information to make the decisions they need to make. Probably the most telling or demonstrative example of our work, hopefully you all received and read cover to cover the Rural Minnesota Journal. It is really, the demand and interest in it far exceeded, quite frankly, what we anticipated. The number of editorials and newspapers around the state saying it's about time. There was at least one publication that was really just dedicated to rural Minnesota was long overdue. This bill is really designed to legislatively mandate the center to compile a status report on rural Minnesota at the beginning of each biennial session. As you know, no such report currently exists. And we believe that if such a report is to exist, we would be the appropriate organization to compile it. Over the years, the legislature has made many efforts to try to set the tone at the beginning of those odd-numbered years, at the beginning of the biennial sessions, to set the tone for what's to come. A good example of that is what I believe is now the defunct Horizons Conference, where legislators would come together and hear about all kinds of information, and it really kind of set an informational tone in a very nonpartisan way to move the session forward. I see such a report in that light. It would simply be a report that we would compile in conjunction with state agencies and a variety of other organizations around the state to give to you at the beginning of each legislative session and kind of set the tone to talk about how rural Minnesota is doing. And I think it would not only be of great benefit to rural legislators, but quite frankly, I think urban and suburban legislators would benefit quite a bit as well. This bill, in a sense, would provide some type of official platform for such a report to be disseminated to you, and of course to be disseminated statewide. I would be remiss if I didn't mention the fact that there is no fiscal note associated with this bill. We're not asking for any money to do this. As you probably know, the center does receive a very modest appropriation each year of $150,000. That has been cut back over the years. But the reality is that that amount of money now comprises about somewhere between 20 and 25% of our entire budget. We think rural Minnesota needs this. We think legislators and policymakers at the state, county, and local level need this. And in some ways, I guess I would probably say we would do it anyway, because we're not asking you for any money to do it. But with the passage of this bill, quite frankly, it would give us some type of official platform to be able to present this to you, to present this to the state, and kind of set the tone of how rural Minnesota is doing at the beginning of each biennial session. So with that in mind, I guess I'll close my comments.
Mr. Chair, any questions? Representative Sertich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish. Living through my sixth legislative session this year, looking at the date of March 1st for when the report's due, in reality, 31. I think that's a little too late. When Dr. Geller talks about setting a tone and important to get information, I wholeheartedly agree with him. By the time March 1st rolls around, we're already way past setting a tone for the session. And in a sped-up session, there's a potential where budget targets are already set and we're already way down the road of where we're going here. Can we bump up that date to January 1st?
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair and Representative Sertich, it's a good point, because when you brought it up, I'm thinking of the report, the studies that I've seen that are directed to the chairs of the committee by like January 15th, something like that. Would that be Dr. Geller said that would be fine with him.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Sertich, I actually put that language in, and I believe it just says no later than. Clearly the intent was to deliver it well before that date.
Good point. Do you want to make that amendment?
I do in a second. I actually have the, sadly as it is, the Rural Minnesota Journal is sitting on my bedside table, so I that's where I'm reading it. But it's not that it puts me to sleep, actually, either. But also just philosophically, do we just want to do it every other year? I mean, we budget every other year, but changes are going on in rural Minnesota. The policy that we're implementing from year to year affects us in different ways from year to year. Do we not maybe want to see this every year? We set a budget, we start implementing the budget in the odd numbered year. By the even numbered year, we know some effects already of what policy that we just implemented was. But then we also know what the needs are. We are doing policy in even numbered years now. Potentially some of where bonding dollars go I could see some good studies coming from the World Center about where bonding dollars, where bonding priorities might be in rural Minnesota happening in even numbered years. Might this be something important enough to report back to us every year?
Back again, Mr. Chair, Representative Sertich. The reason why we went every other year is more logistical than anything else. To be able to do this is going to tap the goodwill and cooperation of multiple state agencies that hold the data that we use to provide the information. Not that I don't clearly understand the need you're expressing and the importance of it, but if in fact we try to do it every year in a comprehensive way, it could consume an enormous amount of not only our time and energy, but of, you know, the deed, education, health, that all have an important role in providing you with good information on the status of the rural economy, rural health care, educating our rural kids, and so on and so forth. And so using the Horizons Conference or the conference recently at the Humphrey Institute as a way of kind of setting the tone, it seemed to me that, you know, at the beginning of the biennial session might be appropriate. Not that, quite frankly, doing it every year wouldn't be a marvelous idea, because you're absolutely right. Things do change. If we chose to go that route, then we'd have to talk a little bit more about a fiscal note on this. But it's not that a lack of seeing the need.
Representative Sturdy. Well, Mr. Chair, potentially we could get that language that Representative Cornish talked about that is generally given to other reports, and we can just do it at the time when we're rolling it into the bill just to save time.
Yes. Okay. We'll make those. Representative Slawick first.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, I just want to say I support this bill. I think it's a really good idea. I've heard good things about Chair Gunther being involved with this group, and I would say suburban legislators don't know as much as we should know. But I'm surprised to see it legislated. You know, we are often told about do things really have to go into the law, and you talked about why, but it seems to me that it seems you could do this without approval from the legislature. Couldn't you?
Dr. Geller.
Mr. Chair, Representative Slawick, absolutely we could do it without this bill. And as I said, we would do it with or without this bill. Sometimes having an official platform to be able to do it provides a certain amount of importance, if you will, to this. Being able to come to committees such as this and other committees to talk about what's going on in the other 80 counties outside the 7-county metro area, and having such a platform, is of value. But I won't argue your point that it could be done maybe not in exactly the same way, but certainly with the same intent, with or without.
Ms. Lennon-Slack, I think it legitimizes the report, number one. Number two, it ensures we're going to get it.
Mr. Chair,
Representative
if we wanted to put everything we wanted to legitimize in writing, we'd never get out of here, right?
True. Point well taken. Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, I was just thinking maybe this is a consent calendar item.
I think we're going to roll it over for possible inclusion. Otherwise, it wouldn't be very much that way. Any other questions? Seeing none, I will renew my motion to have House File 3947 be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Representative Slawick. Welcome to your committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 3944.
Very well.
receive.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and thank you, Chair Gunther, for being a co-author on this bill. The good thing is this bill is not three things. It's not Rumpelstiltskin, it's not Rumpelstiltskin-like, and it's not Rumpelstiltskin-istic. Did I get all those right? There's no money involved, so that's the good thing, is we don't have to worry about putting straw in the gold and that being part of it. But House File 3944 is really about child care and co-payments, and I see it as more of a technical change or a tweak to the current law. We've run into some problems on co-payments, which we know that have gotten increased quite significantly for our families, and they're having some trouble making them. What is happening out there in the communities is we have some third parties that are helping families making their co-payments, and the Department of Human Services interpreted that may be a problem and it would roll into the eligibility and count as income for those families. This is very important to pass this as a tweak because we have folks that this will make the difference for getting quality child care and not getting quality child care. So simply by allowing third parties to assist with making the co-payment, we'll be able to move forward and have everybody keep safe, stable child care.
Very neat. And I also want to add the department is absolutely not against this.
Thank you. So we could have lots of testifiers if you'd like that, Mr. Chair.
I don't think we'll need them. Is there something you want to delay this over for being able to substitute the Senate file in the omnibus bill? How do we make that motion? Anybody help me out? Just do it? I just made it?
Mr. Chair?
What
are you attempting to do?
We want to substitute the Senate file. I think we can do that at markup.
Yes.
Yeah, I think we can do that. You can just, when comes time for markup, we'll just substitute the Senate file.
Mr. Chair, there was an issue about missing deadline yesterday, so this way it's identical to the Senate file, and we could have this bill travel along that way and go through
whatever you want. With that, any questions on this bill?
Is this for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill?
That's correct. It doesn't make any difference. So with that, seeing no questions, all in favor of this House File 3944, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
We don't have to do that, do we?
No.
It's laid over for possible.
It's just a vote of our confidence in this particular
item. I appreciate that. That's great. Thank you, Lord. Great bill. Representative Sirdic.
Well, Mr. Chair, that went well. Let's try this one. I move House File 3638 for possible inclusion in the omnibus.
Very well.
And then, Mr. Chair, I'd also like to move the DE 1 amendment to put the bill in the shape I'd like it.
Okay. So move. You want to explain your amendment? You want to incorporate this?
Is that what you might want to vote on it.
Okay. Representative Sirdic moves the DE-1 amendment. All in favor of that motion, signify. No. Yeah, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Would you explain your amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We're looking right here at a bill that deals with initiative funds all over the state. Regionally, there are the state is covered with areas that serve entrepreneurs and businesses. And for a long time, there's been a great partnership between these initiative funds and the state of Minnesota. We're looking at a way to get these initiative funds more capital so that they can better serve our business community, our entrepreneurial community, more local than we are. And I think that we've found a creative way to get them some funds so that they can help out these businesses and entrepreneurs, and at the same time actually give this money back when they're all done using it. I think it's a great model that has been worked on. It's went through a few different phases, but I think we're finally onto something here that would be great. Our initiative funds are all in every single region, and I think they do a great job of connecting. I mean, they have the resources and the connections locally and can serve them better, I think, at times than we can at a state level if we just have them get the capital. And with us is one of the folks that runs one of these initiative funds from my area, the state, and I'll let Mr. Rainier continue with the testimony.
Welcome to the committee. Give me a name for the record.
Thank you, Chair Gunther. my name is Tom Rainier. I'm the president of the Northland Foundation. We serve the seven counties of northeastern Minnesota. We're one of the six Minnesota initiative funds, as Representative Sertich noted. approximately 18 years ago, I think I probably sat in this hearing room testifying on a very small portion of a very sweeping bill that was called the Rural Development Act of 1987. Mm. It did a lot of things, some good, some not so successful. But this very small portion, which was called the Challenge Grant Program, was, I think you'll agree, was a superb public investment. It resulted in the capitalization of six regional loan funds administered by DEED, or DTED, I'm not sure what it was called then, and delivered by the then fledgling Minnesota Initiative Funds. We were only a year and a half old and had not begun to do actual lending to businesses. With that bill, you started something very significant. Combined with other public and private sources, the Initiative Foundations over that 18-year period have collectively made over 2,900 loans to rural businesses, both startups and expansions. The loans have totaled over $140 million. They've leveraged, mostly in private sector dollars, nearly $800 million in additional investment, and conservatively retained or created over 33,000 jobs for rural communities. The good news about this story is now 18 years later, virtually all of that original investment by the state, which was $6 million in 88 technically, and $6 million in 93, is still out there, still in our portfolios, and still helping small businesses and entrepreneurs. So why is there a need for more capital? Much has changed in the world of economic development finance. Aside from pure inflation, we're doing more deals and we're doing much larger deals. Originally, the challenge grant legislation authorizes to do up to $100,000, which was really scary for us to do a $100,000 deal. As Representative Sertich knows, a few years ago, the Northland Foundation in the small city of Babbitt made one loan for $1.7 million, and that business is still there. The other factor is that utility companies such as Minnesota Power and so on have really, as a policy, backed away from community development finance, and we're filling that void. State agencies such as Iron Range Resources indeed have ever-decreasing lending budgets. This year, the Northland Foundation alone will probably do more loans than DEED will statewide. I believe DEED's budget is about $3 million, and we'll do at least that just in northeastern Minnesota. The other thing is business has changed. Capital needs to be more flexible, needs to be more adaptable to new types of businesses. We need to form new ways of addressing capital needs to businesses, creating new forms of equity, near equity, and so on. For instance, technology businesses typically can't provide building, land, equipment for collateral. Usually the collateral's in someone's head. And it's very hard to get banks comfortable with that type of lending without another lender like us backing them up. With these flexible dollars, one initiative foundation will increase its micro-lending, another will make equity investments to start up technology firms. For our part, Northland plans to package both debt and equity into the same deals. And the final and most important point, as Representative Sertich points out, we're going to use this money for 10 years, we're going to pay interest only annually, and we're going to pay it back, and all six initiative funds are in a position to guarantee repayment. Within the first 2 to 3 years, we'll likely have all of this $12 million invested in rural communities. If we make a modest profit, we've made some good choices. If we lose some money on businesses that don't make it, that just means that we're doing what we're supposed to be doing and taking the appropriate level of risk. This really, I don't like to use the term a paradigm shift. It's used too much.
But this is really the way that economic development finance is being done now across the country. There's no more free money out there, and nor should there be. We operate our business finance programs like businesses. Although we are public charities, we're also what's known as CDFIs, which is Certified Development Financial Institutions, which is a designation of the Department of Treasury. Finally, you'll notice that our bill is very brief. We didn't waste a lot of words on this language. We haven't incorporated a lot of job or wage requirements because we really don't want to minimize the flexibility of this capital. On the other hand, creating economic vitality, wealth, family-sustaining job opportunities are not merely a policy or a benchmark for the initiative foundations. It's absolutely inherent in our mission. You probably know that all of the initiative foundations, including the Northland Foundation, make grants. Last year, Northland distributed $1.2 million in grants, a large portion of which went to organizations that help lift individuals and families out of poverty. They provide safe, affordable housing, job training, quality child care, and so on. It would be completely self-defeating and contradictory for us to create low-wage jobs through our lending that perpetuated poverty. It just isn't what we're about. The proof is in our numbers over the years. Just some quick numbers for you. This is the Northland Foundation's numbers, but I'm sure they're very reflective of our counterpart organizations. Northland borrowers have created approximately 5,500 jobs, which amounts to one job per $5,600 invested. A very typical benchmark in the public sector is one job for every 10,000. We track jobs, we track wages, but we don't use these benchmarks because oftentimes we'll do a loan to a business that needs a new piece of equipment to stay competitive and productive. It won't create new jobs, but it'll keep them alive. So we don't like to apply these, but our averages are very positive. Every dollar that Northland Foundation invests has leveraged $7 in mostly private investments. Our average annual remuneration for jobs created is $31,415 per job, based on full-time equivalent. The average compensation exceeds 130% of poverty level for a family of four. I believe the deed's criteria is 110%. 83% of all the jobs we've created are for health insurance. 63% of all jobs created went to persons from low-income households, defined as at or below 80% of median family income. So I think our performance and our record more or less speaks for itself. We really just want to put more capital out there. We've done a lot of research on the needs of rural businesses for not only more capital, but new types of capital. And we think that we're in a good position to deliver it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair and members, just to briefly summarize, we're talking about $12 million of state resources that would be equally divided between the six regions, $2 million per region. They would lend that money out at a very low interest rate, and after 10 years of having that capital in their portfolio, give that money back to the state. A great way to infuse more capital into each region, north, south, east, and west. All the initiative foundations are very excited and on board, looking forward to do this, and hopefully we can help them out at some point in time.
Look forward to it, too. Representative Mahoney.
There you go. Excuse me, Mr. Show guys, again.
I will give you a list of things that we include you in.
Sure. I'm sure you'll come up with something, sir. Actually, my one question is, at the end of the 10-year term of the loan, the qualified organization is required to make the payment back to the state. Just because I've been hearing so much about these interest-only loans on housing and the fear from bankers and other people about what the problems that they bring with them, what is your organization going to do how do you envision that being done? Is it after 10 years, the business will go to a standard financial institution such as a bank and say, we need to refinance this, or are you going to be working with them over the 10 years to get them prepared to repay that? I think it's a great idea, and I'm supportive of it. I just kind of want us as a committee to understand where you're going.
Mr. Rainier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, that's a very good question. Our typical loan terms is 5 to 7 years. We have banks in all of our deals, and the objective, of course, is to get these companies bankable so they don't need the type of financing we give them. If you loaned us right at the beginning of this 10-year period, $2 million, we'd probably have it in circulation within a year and a half to 2 years. It would rotate around once or twice during that 10-year period. What we're trying to get to, frankly, our organization has approximately $15 million in loan capital. And as I said, we operate kind of like a bank. About $7 million of that $15 is debt. So just like a bank, they borrow money at very low interest rates from the Federal Reserve. They loan it out. They pay it back. There's money moving through all the time. We have the capacity just in terms of our total portfolio to handle that debt and pay it back, just like a business. It won't have any effect on the businesses we're borrowing to. You see, so we stopped looking about 6 years ago when the 90s ended. We stopped looking for grants to do this for two reasons. First of all, that money doesn't exist anymore. But also because usually that money comes in a box. And it says you will do this type of business, this type of lending, all these criteria that we can accommodate, but the businesses that we finance can't. We need to get in with the banks and the businesses and other organizations like ourselves and structure deals that help guarantee the success of the business. So us having to pay this money back after 10 years does not affect the businesses whatsoever. It affects us and our bottom line, but hopefully by that time we will have found other sources and paid other money back. The good thing is that we have the wherewithal and the assets to absolutely guarantee repayment, even if every loan that we made during this 10-year period went bad, which obviously we don't anticipate.
Mr. Chair, actually, I really wasn't worried about you.
No.
I was asking, do you work with the businesses over those 10 years to get them a good financial setup? And you did answer it by saying that we're trying to get them bankable, and that's where I was trying to go with
this. We absolutely do.
Okay.
We absolutely do. And we need to be taken seriously as lenders, because we're also philanthropic organizations. Mm-hmm. We don't forgive loans, but we work with our businesses. We go on interest only. We renegotiate the terms. We stay as long as we can with these businesses.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, actually, I'm a fan of the Initiative Fund. I think you do really great work. But I do want to just comment on one thing, which is, this bill that is competing for our money with a number of other projects that have come forward, you know, that everything from small businesses to large businesses. I mean, I guess it would be interesting to know the breakdown in businesses that are being helped, small, large, that sort of thing.
Sure.
I'm not asking for that right at this moment, although you may want to comment. But I do want to say something else, which is you're happy about the flexibility you have, and I think that's good. It's probably one of your strengths. But being accountable by telling us what you did with that money should not decrease your flexibility. And I was just looking at the site that you in the bill, 116J415, that says what you're here for.
Mm-hmm.
And I like everything that it says. It talks about creating new jobs, retaining existing jobs, increasing the local tax base, demonstrating that public dollars induce private funds, providing higher wage levels to the community or adding value, retaining existing businesses, attracting outside business. Those are all fine. I would just like you to think about, and the author can respond to this too, I think it's important that we know what you did do, that we do get a report back, that we do have accountability from these public dollars. And it's going to help you get the money. It'll help you get more of my vote, I'll tell you that. We need to hear back what I think we're long past saying, trust me.
Yeah.
We need to hear back what our public subsidy does. So I'm just wondering if the author could work with you and we could figure out a way just to, get this report back, because I think it would really, you'll benefit from it.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Mayor.
Representative, that'd be very easy for us to do. Had this been an administration initiative, there would have probably been language in here that talked about requirements and reporting requirements. Our assumption is that if you authorize this appropriation, that deed would administer it. It's got to be set up by the commissioner somewhere. And that rules would be written that would reflect the ones that we've lived by for 18 years.
Yes.
We do very, very detailed tracking of jobs, of salaries, benefits, and we do that reporting to deed and every other funder that we have. And it would be very, we would enjoy showing you our
Mr. Chairman, that's not all I need to hear, because I know the initiative. I mean, you have a great reputation out there, and so I just, if we can make sure we get to hear about it in a specific, accountable way, I think that would be important.
Absolutely.
In one way, I think you did give a little accountability for you. You said you started out with $1 million, and you now have how much?
In our loan capital?
Yes.
I think about $16 million.
$16 million. I think that's pretty good accountability.
But I can tell you right now, we're looking, in the next month, we're looking at three deals that we're going to be pressed to find the capital to do. That's the good news. I mean, there's a lot of good, solid economic development activity going on out there. But when you're doing deals that are $500,000, $400,000, and so on, you chip away at that capital. Most of probably about $10 million right now is lent out in our portfolio. So, and the other problem is that some of the money we have, specifically some money from the federal government, although it's good money, two of three deals we're looking at, we can't use it. It's that inflexible. We'll find a place to put it, but we can't use it for the deals that we want to do in the foreseeable future.
Representative, Mr. Chair, and members, if you go to different regions of the state, like Central Minnesota's initiative and other folks, they have different needs. So potentially the federal money that Mr. Rainier's talking about could work for them. And that's why it's important, I think, that when we help them out, we give them that flexibility of micro-lending versus debt, whatever it is, because the needs are different in different regions of the state based upon the businesses that are located there.
Representative Gizelka.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Search, I appreciate you bringing this forward. I'm a co-author on it. I believe in what you're doing here. To the testifier, I'm just curious about the percentage of loans that go in default, because you're taking a little more risk than the average, and I just wanted to know where you're at on that.
Mr. Renner.
Chair Gunther, Representative Gizelka. Over the 18-year period that we've been doing this, we have a loan loss rate of about 8%. It varies year to year from 7 to 10. If you look nationally at organizations like ours who do this kind of lending, that's right about where it ought to be. To be perfectly honest, if we never lose a dime, we ought to just get out of the business, because all of those deals are bankable. If we lose 20%, we ought to get out of the business, because we can't keep enough capital coming through. So a 5 to 10% loss rate over time is very typical, and if you were a banker, you'd choke on that, but for us it's actually quite acceptable.
So, Mr. Chair, some of these businesses then maybe wouldn't have even got off the ground if you hadn't been there.
That, Mr. Chair, that is correct. We can't say in every instance that, but for our financing, this deal would not have come through. Some of them might have happened, but what we bring to it is the ability to do a different structure that increases the likelihood of success. So it's not just will the business get the capital they need, but will it be structured in such a way that it maximizes. It's hard enough to make it as a new business or an expanding business anywhere. So we try and play the role of structuring the deal that maximizes the likelihood of success.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, Representative Sertich renews his motion to have House File 3638 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Good to see you, Tom. Representative Hornstein.
I
Good morning, Mr.
Welcome
Chair.
To our committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. In terms of the motion, I guess we have a couple options. One is to lay it over for inclusion. The other, I just wanted to let the Chair know, I mentioned this to Mr. Beers, that the companion in the Senate is on the floor there, so one option would be to send it there as well. So I leave it up to the discretion of the Chair.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Clark.
I'd like to move the...
Very well. I was kind of waiting for you to do that.
I guess we move the House file at this point.
I think it probably, at this point in time, would be more appropriate to lay it over.
Okay.
We can accept the Senate file as it comes over.
Well, and to that, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And to that, the bill, I would like to move the DE1 amendment, which does conform to the language that was passed in the Senate.
Mr. Chair, I move that amendment.
Representative Clark moves the DE1 amendment. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. What's that?
Oh, yes. there's an oral amendment to the DE1. Thank you.
That wasn't it.
And that is on page 2, line 21. I'd like to add, after subdivision 6, member reimbursements shall be paid for by the Commissioner of Commerce. Member reimbursements shall be paid for by the Commissioner of Commerce. And that was suggested to me by House Research as the appropriate fiscal agent for the task force.
Okay. Everybody understand that oral amendment? So we will. I will move the oral amendment on line 221, member reimbursements by the Commissioner of Commerce.
Mr. Chairman.
Pardon me?
Can I ask a question?
Certainly.
Mr. Representative Hornstein, is there something worked out with the Department of Commerce and how they will pay for that?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Wilkin, I think that that's probably one advantage of laying this over for further inclusion, because there is this small expense related to the task force. But that was just suggested to us by council or by House Research as the appropriate, but no, we haven't had conversations other than that the Deputy Commissioner of Commerce is very familiar with this bill, but beyond that, we haven't had fiscal conversations with them.
Okay.
So we will have those conversations before we have markup. Thank
Absolutely.
You. So we should pass this. All in favor of the oral amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carried.
Were
you supposed to do it, Madam Speaker?
Absolutely.
Okay, now we have to vote on the amendment as amended. I will move the 37 DE. Representative Clark will move that the DE1 amendment be approved as amended. All in favor of that, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Finally, we got it.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, we have it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members, for getting this in the shape that we need it in. Members, originally this bill relates to plug-in hybrid vehicles, and I will discuss why this is a good idea for the state to pursue in just a minute. But I did want to let you know why we did this amendment, and some of you may have come and read the summary or read earlier versions of this bill. Originally, this had to do with the Ford plant and trying to encourage the Ford plant to pursue this kind of technology. But we needed to make this, I think, a little bit more expansive. We have some language that relates to the Ford plants on lines 17 and 18.
But members, this is about much more than just the Ford plant. It is really about moving Minnesota forward as a leader in a very exciting new technology related to automobiles and energy efficiency, a technology that is here and now. And I think we have three bills that I think will help us become a leader in this new technology. Minnesota is very well positioned, which you'll hear from our testifiers. We have an ethanol industry. We have a wind energy industry. We have excellent academic institutions such as Minnesota State Mankato, which is one of four automotive engineering programs in the country. We have 3M, which is doing some research on battery technology that could possibly use in plug-in hybrids. So we really are uniquely positioned to become a leader in which what I think will be a very, very important new economic engine, not only for our state, but potentially the country. You may recall that just last month, President Bush visited the Johnson Works battery facility in Wisconsin. He had mentioned this in his State of the Union address as a very important way for us as a country to become less dependent on foreign oil. So just very briefly, and I think Dr. Morris from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance can familiarize you a little bit more with how plug-in hybrids work, but our strategy is threefold. We have another bill moving in the House that asks the state to procure these vehicles once they become available and provides a grant for Minnesota State Mankato to retrofit a couple of existing hybrid cars into plug-in technology. This is the third piece of the strategy, which is to establish this task force that brings the major stakeholders together, both in state agencies and in the community, to really come up a year from now with a strategy to help move the state forward. There are barriers to this. That's one of the things that's in the charge of this task force. It's very simple and straightforward, the bill. It talks about the different stakeholders who would be on this task force, what their chairs are, how it's appointed, et cetera. And there is a report, and now that I listened carefully to Representative Sertich earlier, the reports of the legislature is due April 1st of 07, but I think that it's going to take a little time for this task force to meet. This is very important. I wouldn't want to move this up necessarily. We're not asking for a package of bills to come out of this task force for the next year, but we do want to get this up and running as quickly as possible. So with that, let me just summarize my comments by saying we are looking at existing hybrid vehicles that are out on the road, on the market today, particularly the Ford Escape and the Toyota Prius, and retrofitting those vehicles with new battery technology that once you plug these cars in overnight at night, they would be capable of getting the first 30 miles on electricity only. And most people, particularly in the urban areas, only drive about 30 miles or less per day. And then thereafter, they would be capable of getting over 100 miles per gallon. And then with the introduction of flexible fuel, even higher than that. So this is a very, very important development, and both in terms of our ability to, again, lessen our dependence on foreign oil, but also make important strides in terms of the environment and climate change and global warming, et cetera. So we have a very interesting coalition. We have people concerned about national security. We have an environmentalist. We have a lot of utility companies, the American Public Power Association, including nine public utilities in Minnesota, are strongly in favor of pursuing this this kind of approach. So with that, members, if you have no questions of me as the author, I can move on to our testifiers.
Very well.
Okay. The first... our first witness is Dee Long, who is with Minnesotans for an Energy Efficient Economy.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. And I am Dee Long with Minnesotans for an Energy Efficient Economy. We will actually have a new name within a month or so, but if I tell you what it is, I'd have to shoot all of you at this point.
Don't tell us.
But very, very briefly, and Dr. Morris can certainly explain the technical reasons why plug-in hybrids are a good idea. We are supportive for several reasons. National security reasons, which has come to the forefront in the United States Senate. Former CIA Director James Woolsey has been working with some of the senators for at least a couple of years on the issue of plug-in hybrids because of their ability, if adopted, to avoid energy dependence on what may be potentially unfriendly foreign sources. There is a bill now in the Senate, bipartisan, introduced by Senators Lugar and Obama, and we will be watching the progress of that. Also, economic reasons. Whoever thought that we'd say, you know, oil's dropped a little today, it's under $65 barrel. Well, again, things have changed enormously, and there certainly is an impact both in terms of the states and national economy on this, as well as the economics for families. Again, mentioned to my husband a weekend ago that look at the bargain down here. You can get gas down in Hastings for $2.50 a gallon. It's probably up considerably today. And then lastly, environmental reasons. A significant portion of air emissions that create problems, including greenhouse gas emissions, are from motorized vehicles. Plug-in hybrids would be very helpful for that. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Your other testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to introduce Dr. David Morris, who's the Vice President of the Minneapolis-based Institute for Local Self-Reliance.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm David Morris with the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, and I'm also on a congressionally created committee to advise the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Energy on energy policy, appointed by the Secretary of Energy under President Clinton and reappointed by the Secretary of Energy under President Bush. And the issue here is that the existing hybrid cars are a wonderful development, but they only travel a very short distance. That is, the Toyota and the Ford cars, General Motors and Honda cars, don't travel at all on electricity. But the Toyota and the Ford cars do. But the battery has to be recharged by a pretty inefficient internal combustion engine. So the next step really is to allow them to plug in. And if they plug in, they can be recharged by the electricity system. And the electricity system doesn't run on oil. A very small percentage of electric power is generated from oil. So while it runs on electricity, it's displacing oil 100%. And then the backup will be the engine. And the engine can be a flexible fueled engine, which will run 85 to 100%. On ethanol, which itself will displace the vast majority of oil. We don't even use oil much for growing the corn and converting it into ethanol. So it really does become a significant oil displacement proposition. The current hybrids are largely internal combustion engine cars with a motor assist. What a plug-in hybrid is essentially an electric vehicle with an engine backup, and so it changes things dramatically. On the electricity side, also, the benefit to the state of Minnesota is that we have an enormous amount of renewable energy in wind power. But wind power is, as we all know, intermittent. If you have the storage capacity in cars, and of course one car doesn't have much storage capacity, but 100,000 and 500,000 will, then suddenly you can generate the electricity whenever the wind is blowing and store it in your car's battery system. So you do, on the electric side, you can in fact begin to pursue in-state generation of electricity at a very significant scale. And on the liquid fuel side, of course, you can do that with ethanol. Minnesota, at the Ford plant, the Ranger vehicle was an all-electric vehicle. It was sold as an all-electric vehicle in 2000 and 2001 to meet the California zero-emission vehicle standard. And it was a flexible fueled vehicle in 2002 and 2003. So it's sort of an interesting, in some way, little history of the Ford Ranger as really the possibility of putting pieces together that really all were there over the last 6 years. So it really has, I think, a lot of possibilities. And the task force is structured in a way that it is heavy on the business side. That is, the people who will be supplying the parts, the people who will be making, assembling, and so forth. So it really will be the first task force that I'm aware of. There have been studies, but task force that I'm aware of that really will be the business industry looking at this as a feasible market-oriented project. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Any questions for the testifiers or author of the bill? Representative Smollett.
Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure who this is for, but is there really going to be giant plugs on the side of our house? or is that just a...
The Vermont Association had some concerns, Mr. Chair and Representative Smollett, but we can know. Okay. No, really, this would be a standard plug in one's garage, really. And in a normal Minnesota winter, we're pretty used to plugging in cars. But again, I think... It should be a very simple and straightforward proposition for consumers.
Representative, just a follow-up, and more seriously, is when I first read this bill, I thought, oh, it's the Ford plant, it's a conversion, and I see it's kind of shifted. I mean, is there, there's another bill coming about that, or are they seriously looking at have the Ford plant doing this? I know now you've kind of separated it out, right? Or can you explain where we're at?
Representative Morris, I could comment, and maybe Dr. Morris as well. We met with a representative from Ford just last week, and there's some very exciting possibilities that the local 879 of the UAW, for example, have put forward about maybe retooling the Ford plant for flexible fuel hybrids, which would get us two-thirds of the way there. And certainly that's been somewhat consistent with at least the rhetoric from Ford Motor. But at this point, they don't have any plans, as a company to look at the plug-ins. Part of what we want to do, at least with the earlier bill that we had in terms of procurement, is to send a message to automobile manufacturers that these, if you build it, we will come. That these are cars that I think would be very popular with consumers. But, at this point, I just, want to honestly reflect what we've heard from Ford, which they have no plans. They haven't closed the door entirely on that, but this is not necessarily in their plan. Now, we may come up with some ideas, and we may have some discussions with them. We have a representative from Ford called for on this task force. So, I wouldn't close the door on plug-in hybrids at that plant. It's certainly something we'd like to see. But it was very important that once we got that information, looking more expansively at how to promote plug-in hybrids as a whole, that we wanted to have this approach rather than focusing specifically on the Ford plant. I don't know if Dr. Morris, you may want to comment on that too.
Yes, if I could, Mr. Chair, Representative. The other bill is a procurement bill. It sends a message that says we will buy if they are available. This one is a task force, and the difference between this and the previous bill is that the previous bill is focused only on financial incentives for the Ford plant, and it seemed to be too narrowly focused, and that this one is more in terms of the plug-in, but there is a piece of it related to the Ford plant for financial incentives, so it becomes a subset, if you will, of this broader focus. And members of the committee, things are happening very quickly out there. So it is quite conceivable that by the time the report is ready to be submitted, Ford could have changed its mind. I'm not saying that they are going to change this mind, their mind, but one representative from Ford said that if you would ask me 6 months ago, I would have said we were adamantly opposed to plug-ins. If you ask me now, I'll say we are fairly neutral. Just last week, a Saab announced that they would have a bio-powered plug-in hybrid within the next year. Now, that's a subsidiary of General Motors right now, although it might not be for much longer. And Toyota just announced 3 days ago that their next Prius will have a 9-mile electric-only driving range and that they're working on a plug-in, even though they're not making a formal announcement about that. So it's all happening very quickly, and I think it's useful not to get stuck on just one focus, although clearly the Ford plant is a part of this bill.
Representative Clark?
Mr. Chair, just can I say a brief follow-up, just very briefly? Just very briefly, I think what I hear in the news, which is where we get a lot of our information, is that Ford is looking at, obviously, if places have incentive packages in place, and you all know this, you've been involved, then maybe we won't get completely shut down. So that's an editorial comment. I think it's good to have things in place, showing we're trying to make some efforts.
Very well. Representative Clark.
Chairman, I'm going to ask a question, and then I have to go vote in another committee, but I wanted to... I'll listen to the tape later.
Ways and means?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But here's the question. I love what this opportunities are here. But the thing that... One of the barriers, and I think you mentioned in here, is
the Minnesota public. When I think about the Minnesota public, the biggest barrier is affordability. How can we afford to buy these cars, I think? So I'm just wondering if you would address that, because, I mean, I know my car died. I had to look at getting another car. The upfront cost is a problem. I can make the case to myself that over a period of time, maybe I'd save a lot of money on the gasoline. But especially if we do a public subsidy, you know, at some point, you know, what can we do? And so would you excuse me while you ask that question for everybody else, and I'll listen later.
Well, Ms. Chair and Representative Clark, one of the things about plug-ins is that you really know how much you're going to save as you drive the car, which is a little different from hybrids. People have been disappointed in the mileage that they're getting on their hybrids. You really do have to know how to drive your hybrid in order to get the mileage. It's true. But in the case of a plug-in,
okay, she left
mile...
didn't stop answering, now she's gone. No, I'm just kidding.
I will be brief. In the case of the plug-in hybrid, when you're driving on electricity, it's costing you in terms of the electric charge between 1 and 2 cents a mile, and when you're driving on gasoline, the cost is about 10 cents a mile. Right now, between 8 and 10 cents a mile, so, and it's going up. So in that sense, you can, you know, actually do your calculations very clearly. Forget about what the EPA says about your mileage and what you're getting. So I think that yes, there will be an additional cost, at least initially as they come in. But in this case, you really can do your back of the envelope calculations. And there will also be an incentive. There was an incentive passed for hybrids. They would apply to plug-in hybrids, and it's a $3,000 incentive, which should cover the increased cost of a plug-in hybrid. This is a federal incentive.
Representative Westerberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I really like the bill a lot. I like the concept and the idea. I think we should be doing what we can to help this out. But I just wanted to call one thing that I think would be important to, you know, consider adding in here a little bit is on the data analysis here, subdivision 5, where it talks about on 2.9, you know, the analysis should compare the initial purchase and the life cycle costs under different scenarios, but it says based on alternative projections of future gasoline prices, and I'm thinking also you should base it off the performance, you know, or the use, the demands on the vehicle to some extent, and I know it's just a minor thing, but I just wanted to mention that you might want to incorporate that to some degree there.
Just a couple quick points, and thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Westerberg. You know, that's, again, something we can work on with the chair as this gets laid over. But I do want to say that, you know, the other bill that's moving in the House and Senate here in Minnesota does call for a grant to Minnesota State Mankato to take a couple of the kinds of cars that Dr. Morris mentioned, a Ford Escape SUV and a Toyota Prius, and retrofit them with the battery, you know, existing battery technology and flexible fuel. And as part of that study, that we have a small grant for Minnesota State Mankato, they would report on some of those performance issues, you know, road tested in Minnesota conditions. So, you know, there is a way to get at that information already, but I think that, you know, it's certainly something that we could charge the task force with doing as well.
Representative Nelson.
I've had many conversations with this. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. But I've had many conversations with Representative Hornstein. I would seriously look at buying one of the Ford Escapes a year ago for my wife. Couldn't get one available in the time frame I needed it. But a few years back, some friends came up from southern United States, and they looked at all our cars here in the wintertime and were wondering if we already had electric vehicles with all the plugs hanging up the front of our cars for the tank heaters. So I think it's a long way we need to go to do this. This is a good bill. I think we should pass it.
Representative Mahoney.
You know, everyone talks about having a car plugged in. I've never had to plug mine in. I've had to start a fire underneath one of them. you know, you talk about the electrical. What kind of kilowatts are we talking to charge one of these batteries? Are we talking 1 kilowatt or...
Okay. Yeah, I mean, basically, you would charge it off your household socket, 110 or 220, I mean, if you want a faster charge. And basically, if you look at the travel, you get about 4 miles per kilowatt hour That's the distance you would travel in 1 kilowatt hour. And we, at the household level, consume about 1 kilowatt of power on average over the year, and we end up with about 8,500 kilowatt hours. So a 1 kilowatt, actually, in the rural areas, you could have a little teeny wind turbine, not these monsters that you see, but actually a little teeny wind turbine, which are more expensive than the big ones that you see in terms of the electricity that they generate, but they could provide almost all the fuel that they would need for the kind of family electric car. So a one kilowatt is more than you would need on a year-round basis in terms of generation. And just one other thing is that even if everybody had an electric had a plug-in hybrid vehicle in Minnesota, we probably wouldn't need any more power plants, which speaks to your question in some different way, because you would get a break on, you would be charged less for charging your battery in the off-peak hours at 2 in the morning rather than at peak hours of 3 in the afternoon, and we have enough off-peak capacity to provide, if not all, a very significant percentage of the amount of electricity that we would need. So even though you obviously need power to charge these things from an electric power plant, we would not be needing to build new electric power plants to supply these cars.
Final comment or question, Representative Mahoney?
Final comment. That didn't really help your cause with the pipe fitter.
You know, it's an interesting topic. I get the impression we could probably sit here for another hour and just bounce questions off you guys, because it's clearly the marketplace has kind of figured out what I think the average person has known for a couple of years, and that is that renewable fuels are the way to go, and sort of 21st century models for moving vehicles are the way to go. So it's a cool subject. With that, Representative Clark, when is your motion to have House File 3719 laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill? Thank you, Representative Barnston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you.
One quick announcement. The Chair has asked me to announce that tomorrow we have 11 bills before this committee, and he would like members to be prompt and on time in the morning so we can start right at 8:15, and that if we do not get any bills that we're not able to get through that morning, apparently we're not going to have an evening session. If we just don't get to the bill, we don't get to the bill. So he would ask members to be, what was the term?
Considerate
of other members. So with that, the committee will be in adjournment. Thank you.